Mr. Valance, Reel 9. We got to the point when you'd been promoted to acting unpaid Lance Corporal, I think, while you were at Ardenna Avenue. Abbey. How did that change your situation? I mean, did it make much of a difference having that slight increase in rank?
No difference at all, really. Most people thought I should have been promoted higher, but it really didn't worry me whether I was promoted or not. We were recovering from the heavy casualties we had suffered, and we're getting reinforced with our own reserves and remnants from other units who joined us. And really, we were so occupied, and life was so hectic that, well, at least I didn't bother about things, whether I had a stripe or two stripes or no stripes. And everyone just got on with doing their job.
Now, the next period was when they gradually began to push forward, Operation Bluecoat and various other things. Which, now, I know this period's vague for you, so we're not going to worry too much about going through it day by day or what happened. Well, what is the next thing you remember with Steele Brownlee? Because you were in his troop now,
yes,
four troop.
Yes, well, I've got on very friendly with him from here on. We've had crossroads in the past, but in a friendly sort of way. And I had great admiration for him as a troop leader. He knew what he was doing, and I hope that I knew what he was doing. And we had confidence in each other and the rest of the troop. It is vague what went on then, because we seem to be on the move, backwards and forwards. I mean, the first light you would move forward to the positions you may have been in the night before, and perhaps through the day you would advance a bit or pull back a bit or go down the flank, and then at night go back to a leaguer somewhere. And life was very hectic. There was very little sleep. And I'm afraid that offhand, I can't recall the details.
That's fine. How about just some general things? Just what about, did mines worry you a lot? Either anti-personnel mines when you're out of the tank, and of course anti-tank mines in the tanks. Well, were they a worry to you?
No, I never came across anti-personnel mines anyway. Actual mines, very seldom. I do recall on one occasion, somewhere about this time, we were advancing over open country and by a road, and the tank in front of me went up on a mine. It just blew his track. The track broke, of course. And I remember, I think it was the squadron leader's tank. I went up in the tracks, followed in his tracks, so that I knew it wouldn't go on another mine, and we got the tow rope out and fixed it without going anywhere other than in the track marks on the ground and pulled him back out to a safe area.
And who was the squadron commander at that time?
Of course, unless I'm mistaken, it was Hutchinson. At that time, a major, Pinky Hutchison, was his nickname. His name was Douglas.
And another question, what about, were you much aware of this sort of German bazooka-style weapon that was, seems to, it just seems to crop up occasionally in accounts?
Certainly, I think it was slightly after this that we mixed up with them and found it. My first experience of them was when I saw something fly through the air and it landed on the back of my tank and didn't explode. And I thought at first it was a new type of shell or mortar bomb that hadn't gone off. and I just threw it off onto the ground. And then I learned it was the bazooka that had fortunately landed on the bedding roll at the end of its flight, and that was all right. But we did lose tanks too.
Was there a, I mean, that must have made you rather cautious in approaching infantry, German infantry.
We're always very cautious approaching German infantry. Certainly it made one look more carefully, made one cautious in approaching hedgerows or places of concealment that they could use. Yes, quite right.
And what about other anti-tank weapons? I suppose the anti-tank gun, the 88, you were aware of that one?
Well, we knew that had done the danger, done the damage at Calne, of course. Very much aware of that, but and also the guns on the German tanks and their smaller anti-tank guns, which were quite powerful enough to brew the Sherman up.
So what incidents do you remember from that? There was the advance, I mean, there's a lot of fighting on the Veer Road.
Yes.
And do you remember much about that?
Well, I do remember going across the Veer Road and certainly firing across it. We, the first time that I had come across there was a German horse-drawn transport. And we shot some up over the Veer Road. And also, some, I remember some SP anti tank guns we shot up there. And, but the details of it all really are beyond me, you know.
What's the next thing you do remember?
Can you
well, the sort of Bercy, and then they started advancing through La Quille, La Bruyere, La Hook Rock,
yes.
In the middle of August. We're into August here,
yes.
And the Falaise Gap operations.
Oh, yes, yes. But before that, before the Falaise Gap, we moved at night across to the west, to the edge of the American zone. And that was an extraordinary move, because we moved in the evening at night, but it was quite light, it was light until probably midnight, until midsummer. But it was so dry, and there was so much dust, and each tank commander was told to have a cigarette burning on the top of the tank all the way as an to the one behind. It really was huge clouds of dust. The Germans must have been aware that something was going on. The noise of the whole division moving and the huge clouds of dust. And we moved across there, I forget now what the place was called that we went to. And there, of course, it was close country, much more dense than around the Calne area, more small fields, Bocage type country, hedgerows, banks. And at about that time, we had, I forget what they were called, the spikes fitted onto the front of the tank. Instead of the tank riding up over a bank or a hedgerow, they would dig into it and push it away and push a gap through it, which was a great help.
How did that work? I can't quite see how that works.
Well, there were, I think, four spikes about 2 feet long, fixed with a bar to the front of the tank at about 2 feet off the ground, roughly. And they stuck out quite some way in front of the tracks, so that as the tank came to the bank, they dug into it. And instead of the tracks then riding up over the bank, they pushed the whole bank in front of it. which was a great advantage. Because if you climbed a bank, A, you were blind, you were only looking at the sky going up, and you exposed the whole front and the bottom of the tank, and then you came down with a crash the other side. But if you could just push through it, then you were concealed and you were alert the whole way through. Whoever thought of them, that was a very good idea.
And you kept them on throughout this period?
Yes, I think we kept them on all the time we had the Shermans.
From then on? Any other, were there any other adaptions that went on?
Yes, there was. I may have already mentioned that when the tanks were building up so easily, because they were, A, there, because the armour plating wasn't very good, and B, because they were carrying a double load of ammunition, we had rectangular armour plates welded over the sides where the ammunition was. I don't think they helped much.
What's the next thing then? You'd moved round to the American sector into the Bocage area.
Yes.
Were you actually in the American sector or alongside it?
Alongside it. Alongside it. I personally didn't see any Americans. There was a vast amount of bombing going on about this time. The RAF coming over and the Americans had huge fleets of bombers. On one occasion, dropping them in the wrong place on our side.
You actually saw that?
Yes. But got them on us personally, about, I suppose, a mile away. You friendly forces were in the wood. Mostly Canadian, I think. And eventually we made our way down to the south of Falaise and then turned up and came up to the north with very hectic time, lots of the German army pulling back, all held up, and a lot of fighting going on, lots of backwards and forwards, toing and throwing.
Any specific incidents you remember? That is in August, isn't it?
Yes. Well, there must be incidents, but I can't recall any.
Two things that come from Steele Brownlee's account. One is that you were hit by a bazooka that actually opened your petrol and it was pouring out.
It was later.
I was later, sorry, okay.
It did happen later, yes.
Okay. Was there much signs of the there's a lot of devastation in the Falaise Gap.
Yes.
Did you see much of that, the remnants?
Tremendous amount. Burnt out vehicles, dead horses, dead Germans, burnt out guns, tanks, everything you can imagine. Most of the roads were completely blocked with burned out vehicles, etc. I think that damage had probably been done from the air. And we mostly travelled across country because everything was turned out. I think eventually we met up with some Poles who had come down from the north. So we knew then that the gap was closed, so to speak. We learned later that quite a lot of the Germans had got out, but didn't really affect us.
And what's the next thing you remember? I know it's difficult for this time, but.
Well, I can't recall exactly what we did. I think. We must have had a rest about that day for a time. And then we started to chase after the Germans. But the next big thing that happened was the night march up the Allianz. When we were told about it, it rather came as a surprise that we were to replenish and bomb up and to continue advancing all through the night.
That was unusual, obviously, because you normally lagered, didn't you?
Yes, extremely unusual, the first time it ever happened. But however, with all in good heart, the opposition at this stage was comparatively light, and we thought it was a jolly good thing. We could see the end of the war almost in sight. And I think we started off at about 6 in the evening, and we were not the leading squadron, and we met no opposition. I saw no opposition at all, just good swan across, and we were just told to keep nose to tail and keep in touch with the vehicle in front, and we wouldn't lose the way in the dark. Quite late in the evening, when it was dark, Colin was stopped, and after a while I became suspicious of why we were stopped for such a long time. So I walked ahead and found that all the crew in the tank in front of me from another troop were sound asleep, and there was not a vehicle in sight in front of them. So I knocked them up, went back to my tank, and overtook that tank and just swung on in the dark, hoping I would catch those which, needless to say, we did. We just swung on right through the night, and as it got light, we halted and fanned out and discovered that we were at Amiens, which was a tremendous advance, well behind the German front line.
Was there any opposition at all during that night?
Not as far as I was concerned, because we weren't the leading squadron at all.
There's supposed to be stories of German vehicles joining the column unaware of things.
Right.
Did you see any of that?
No, I didn't. No, but I did hear of it, and that did happen. And a corporal in one of our scout cars, I believe at that time, captured a German general in the morning. But for me, it was just a straightforward ride forward. I think it was the following day when we were in a field spread round the edge of it, and there were a number of German vehicles in the vicinity that had been abandoned, and I strolled across with some friends to one, and we found a German officer's greatcoat and hat and boots and so on. And rather foolhardy, I put them on and said, "Take me back as a prisoner for a joke to the squadron leader." And I was almost shocked as they took me in to the squadron area. I very quickly took them off.
Who nearly shot you, the guard or?
No, just some of our crews had shot past the tragedy. Then I'd already been taken to the squadron leader, who said, "Well, I was crewed as a sort of German," and all he said was, "Well, take him back to the echelon." It was very, very sort of amusement.
Did you have any sort of reception from the French civilians when you reached Amiens? Because they mustn't have been expecting you, really.
Well, we personally didn't see many. I always keep saying this, but it's perfectly true. You've got daylight, we spread out over the countryside, and we only saw the odd farmer or his family or working or so somebody working, an agricultural worker. When we've advanced again, went through by road through Amiens, yes, then the French were very friendly. Cheering, clapping, waving flags, handing out drinks, and so on. I do recall it was shortly after this that when we were advancing without apparent opposition, and I was fired on by a German tank gun from front.
Was this a bazooka or a normal one?
No, a normal anti-tank, probably 50 millimetres, I would think. And one's reaction, if you wanted to stay alive, was when you were fired on, to get the hell out quick, to move. And I branched off to the left, and the next shot hit me in the side, in the petrol tank. And strangely enough, I think, because that tank was full, absolutely full, we hadn't used any from that tank that day, it didn't catch fire, which by the standards was a miracle. And the petrol just poured out, and then we stopped under cover and just let the petrol come out the whole lot. And the Germans who fired it, the infantry went and outflanked them and brought them in, about half a dozen of them. I went and had a chat with them.
So that was exceptionally lucky from the start, because that was the reputation of the Sherman.
Yes, absolutely. The only time I think anybody ever heard of that happening. It was also very inconvenient, because there were lots of petrol fumes in the tank itself, which one could get accustomed to, but which then prevented you lighting the cooker, or the co-driver lighting the cooker to make the brew. So we did go short of our drinks of tea. And that night, we couldn't cook in the tank, and we weren't allowed to cook outside. So we had something called cold food. But I think that after about 3 days, a reinforcement tank was sent up, and that one went back to be repaired.
And anything else in that time? You ran out of petrol as well, was that a bit later than that?
Well, it was about that time.
Were there difficulties with petrol supplies when you were advancing that fast?
Well, when we were going along these long distances, yes. Because the Eswell had to go back a long way to get the petrol, and so they didn't always have it ready for us. But, I do remember running out of petrol, and the driver saying we've got only a couple of pints left, and there was a French cafe, and I thought, well, a good place to stop, which we did, and they made us very welcome. I think we were there for a couple of hours until the petrol lorry came along, and we filled up and advanced on. And on the way there, two German lorries were obviously hidden well, and the advance went past them. They came out on an adjacent road to us, parallel road, and I looked and we were heading along in the same direction. And we dealt with those. And then carried on and rejoined the squadron. It was quite unusual.
Anything else from that time? Where were you moving now? This is—I mean, you moved eventually after Amiens. They charged on toward Belgium.
I can't recall the names of the places and all the incidents. And the days were full. One started the first light, and didn't go into leak until the last light, and then you had to bomb up and fill up with petrol and so on, and so you got very little sleep.
Did you start to suffer from exhaustion?
No, I think we were exhilarated. We thought everything was going well, we were winning the war, and it was going to be over. Casualties at this stage were very light, and we didn't mind at all, because I was a young, 21, 22 years old, the great adventure.
Were you enjoying being in command of a tank?
Oh yes, very much so. Of course, you felt you had more control over your own existence, as it were.
So what exactly would you do as a tank commander? You didn't control anything yourself, did you? Or did you? I mean, what about the moving of the turret round? Was that you?
That would be the commander, yes.
How did you do it? The gunner had the controls.
Had the controls, yes.
And what were the controls? Were they... I don't think we discussed this.
Yes, we did. They were hydraulic. Electrically controlled, because they ran the battery down. And I think on the Sherman, it was a spade grip which you turned left or right. And he elevated and pressed the gun on the Sherman with a gear wheel handle.
So you'd order all that, and you'd also you'd have your radio set.
Yeah, and of course you would direct the driver where to go.
Through the intercom.
Yeah. And tell the loader, the operator, what to load, and so on, and then control, and aim the gunner. You would go with the traversing valve on the target, steady on, give him a range, describe the target, and he would then come back on, or otherwise, control fire.
So you controlled everything?
Yes.
Who would fire the smoke, the smoke projector?
The radio operator.
So you actually fired or did nothing, you were just the person who controlled everything?
Yeah. The only thing I did on occasions was to throw out either grenades or smoke grenades, which you had in the hand grenade, just shooting out. And my own personal weapon was a 3-8 pistol. I remember sitting on the bank one day and thought, well, I'll give this a bit of a clean. And as I pulled it out of the holster, it went off and fired. Unfortunately, it didn't hit anybody. But it improved my respect for it enormously.
Did you have any stems or anything stuck on the back of the tank?
I think they were inside. They weren't outside, were they? Certainly the radio operator was on the line, and I think the co-driver. I think the driver had a pistol, the same as the commander. And the gunner, I think he probably had a stem.
And they were carried inside?
Inside, yeah. So if you had to bail out, you were supposed to grab one of those, which was pretty impossible.
Anything else about the sort of daily life in the tank?
Well,
during this advance?
It was... Well, I hope to have a breakfast with sauce, which could, say, be tinned bacon if you had a chance to warm it up, if impossible to eat it cold. Or it could just be biscuits and chocolate and tea, which you would have on the move if you didn't get a chance to have it before.